Today is the first day of the second trimester of the Milton Gesher program. It's January 4th. We're in the second hour. And this particular class is called Probing the Heart and Soul, Insights of the Great Hasidic Masters into the Weekly Torah Portion. This week's Torah portion is the last Torah portion of the book of Genesis, the book of Bereshit, and the last Torah portion is called Parshat Vayechi. It deals with the end of the Joseph narratives. And the Joseph narratives began three parshiot earlier. So what we have to do is summarize briefly what's been going on for the last three Torah portions so that we can understand what's going on in this week's Torah portion, so we can see what one of the Hasidic masters said about this week's Torah portion. So just let me give you a brief review. It was at the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev, and near the middle end of Bereshit, that we met Yosef as a 17-year-old boy who seemed to be very talented and also very aware of his talent. A little bit full of himself, perhaps, a little bit stuck up, a little bit spoiled by his father, who gave him the many-colored coat. And he had a series of dreams, two dreams that are mentioned in the Torah, whose simple meaning seemed to be that he would lord it over his brothers, they would bow down to him, even his father and mother would bow down. And as a result of those dreams and the personality and the behavior that they indicated, his brothers hated him. And that's an understatement. Make a long story short, his brothers sold him into slavery, right? They were alone in the fields, grazing with the sheep. Excuse me, I have a terrible pain in my foot.
Oh,
I'm sorry, I can't.
Can you walk on it?
Can you walk on it?
Spread your toes.
Take your shoe off.
Step.
It went away.
Your foot in
under
rear.
Your
Jewish
bra. Step.
You're
going to
get a zillion.
Step.
You need to take blood from your feet.
Yeah, no,
thank you.
Ketchup. Teaspoon of ketchup.
Mustard.
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 Yeah. Exactly. Mustard.
I can
anyway.
Walk a moment. Walk a moment.
Just thank you, Barbara.
Yeah, that's
motherly,
please. There we go. Take your shoe off. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, and through the interpretation of dreams and through the exercise of his great talents, he becomes very quickly the second in command in the nation of Mitzrayim, in the state of Egypt. He interpreted Paro's dreams to understand that there would be 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. He's in charge as the viceroy, the second in command, the minister of agriculture and of the economy, of saving up the grain from the 7 years of plenty so that when the 7 years of famine come, there'll be what to eat. During the second of the 7 years of famine, when not only the Egyptians are coming to him and asking for food, but representatives of many surrounding nations where there's also a famine are coming and asking for food, his brothers from Canaan come to Egypt to buy food. They don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. He acts towards them, and it doesn't say why, acts towards them roughly and gruffly, doesn't reveal himself, accuses them of being spies. He takes one of the brothers prisoner, Shimon, and says, the rest of you guys go back to your father in the land of Canaan, and if you want to get your brother back, Shimon, and if you want to buy food again, you'll have to prove to me that you're not spies. How will you prove that? By showing me that the story you told me of having a younger brother didn't come with you, by showing me that that's really true, you'll have to bring that brother, who of course is Benjamin, down to Egypt. Eventually, the brothers do come back. They bring Benjamin. Joseph sees them. He says, I understand that you're not spies. Very good. He lets Shimon out of prison. He gives them food in exchange for the money that they pay and sends them on their way back to the land of Canaan, except for the fact that he plants his goblet in the knapsack of Benjamin, and after the brothers have gone out of the city limits of Egypt, sends the police after them. They're arrested, they're brought back to the palace, and Joseph says to them, why did you steal my goblet? You're all going to be slaves. No, 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 only Benjamin will be my slave. The rest of you can go back to your father in peace. And at that point, Judah makes an impassioned plea and says, you can't do that. We're all guilty. If Benjamin stays with you and doesn't come back to us to the land of Canaan, our father will die of grief. And I myself, Judah, I promised him, I'm a surety for Benjamin that I'd bring Benjamin back, and I want you to take me as a slave in place of Benjamin so Benjamin could go back to his father and his father won't die of grief through the loss of Benjamin. At that point, Joseph breaks down and reveals himself to his brothers. They're, of course, incredulous. They don't believe it until finally they understand this indeed is Joseph, and he says, bring your father from Canaan to here. You'll all come to Egypt, I'll take care of you, and in all these years of famine, everything will be fine. For 17 years, the family lives there in Egypt with Joseph until Father Yaakov passes away, and then the whole family goes back to Canaan to bury him, to bury Yaakov together with Joseph, and later they come back, and at this point, when Yaakov is no longer alive, they have to deal with the matters that happened so many years ago when Joseph was sold into slavery. Perhaps while Yaakov was alive, he kept the family together. He was like the glue that kept things together. But when he's gone, there's a fear that all hell will break loose, and an effort has to be made at reconciliation. That's this week's parsha. We're going to look at a certain element in this week's parsha in the eyes of a certain Hasidic author. There's a few little details that have to be mentioned and a few verses that have to be read. Number one is, we have to remember, in order to understand what we're going to read, that Yaakov, the patriarch of the family, before his death, before he's buried in Canaan, he brings the whole family together and blesses them. Each brother is called a tribe. They're the fathers of the 12 tribes. Each tribe is blessed. And in the blessing of Yehuda, of Judah, it is said that Judah will be the leader of all the tribes, leader of the Jewish people. He will be the king. I just want to read those verses, which means that we are in chapter 49 of Genesis. You can certainly open up and read together with me. 49, verses 8 to 10.
The bilingual will be 107.
107. And in this book, it's 80. In the English only JTS, it's page 80. Genesis 49, 8. So in the blessing of Yaakov to Judah, to Yehuda, it says, you, O Judah, your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the nape of your foes. Your father's son shall bow down low to you. Judah's a lion's whelp. On prey, my son, have you grown. He crouches, lies down like a lion, like the king of beasts who dare rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Yehuda, nor shall the ruler's staff from between his feet, so that tribute shall come to him, and the homage of peoples be his. Okay. So he's destined to be the leader, the king of the Jewish people. I also want to read, all this is background for what we're about to do. I want to read about the burial of Yaakov in the land of Canaan. So this is in Bereishit 50, verse 7. And I'm just following the verses that I have listed on the sheets that I gave out. So we're looking in 50. Verse 7. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the officials of Paro, the senior members of his court, and all of Egypt's dignitaries, together with all of Joseph's household, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the region of Goshen, which is where they were living in Egypt. Chariots too and horsemen went up with him. It was a very large group. When they came to Goren Hatad, which is beyond the Jordan, they held there a very great and solemn lamentation, and they observed the mourning period of 7 days for his father. And when the Canaanite inhabitants of the land saw the mourning at Goren Hatad, they said, this is a solemn mourning on the part of the Egyptians. That is why it was named Avel Mitzrayim, which is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he instructed them. His sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, the field near Mamre, which Avram had bought for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. And that, of course, is in the city of Hebron. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. That's all the background. And now we're ready to focus on the few verses that will take up our interest for the next 45 minutes, beginning with verse 15 to verse 21. Here we go. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong that we did him decades ago? We sold him into slavery." So they sent this message to Joseph. "Before his death, your father left this instruction. So shall you say to Joseph, 'Forgive, I urge you, the offense and guilt of your brothers who treated you so harshly. Therefore, please forgive the offense of the servants of the God of your father.'" So if we just paraphrase what we read, the brothers are afraid that Joseph is going to take revenge against them. So they send a messenger to him. They don't go directly. And the messenger says that Father Yaakov, before his death, told us that when he's already gone, we should tell you that he said to forgive us. And since he said to forgive us, therefore we request that you forgive us. And Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him. His brothers went to him themselves. I guess when they heard that he was in tears, that he wasn't going to take revenge, then they came directly to Yosef, flung themselves before him, and said, "We are prepared to be your slaves." They're so full of guilt. But Joseph said to them, "Have no fear. Am I a substitute for God? Besides, although you intended me harm, God intended it for good, so as to bring about the present result, the survival of many people." In other words, if I had not been sold into Egypt, if I had not been there to interpret Pharaoh's dream about the 7 years and the 7 years, had I not been there to be appointed to be the viceroy, to amass food during the 7 years of plenty, so that be what to eat during the 7 years of famine, if that hadn't happened, the whole world would have starved, including you guys. So look, you might have intended evil, but God had this big plan that was all for good. So don't be so uptight. I'm not going to take revenge against you. I see it's part of the divine plan. God intended it for good, so as to bring about the present result, the survival of many people. And so, fear not. I will sustain you and your children. Thus he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. End of the story.
Where are any of Jacob's wives? I know Rachel's deceased. His other wives, are any of them still alive?
Unmentioned. That's all I can say. Unmentioned. So, there is a question that we want to begin with in studying these verses. And we'll specifically study them from a Hasidic point of view. I'll explain in a minute. I want to begin with the question. And the question is in verse 15, the verse we just read, 15. Chapter 50, verse 15. That verse had said, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, etc. The question is, what does it mean when they saw that their father was dead? What do you mean they saw? He died a few weeks ago. They saw then that he was dead. They saw the dead body.
They just buried him too.
They just buried him. They just had a whole week of burial procession and mourning, and then they come back from the funeral and they saw that the father was dead. So there must be something more here. What do you mean they saw that his father was dead? And when they saw he was dead, they said, what if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays it back, etc.? What did they see?
They saw he wasn't alive.
They saw he wasn't alive. Thank you very much, Myra.
Well, then, I mean, it's a realization. Right. I mean, it's like, you know.
It's a realization. Right? Exactly. Meaning?
They saw that the leader that had held them together was gone. They were, that realization.
Absolutely.
Well, they can see that there is a big difference with the Egyptian brother that is a master and them. And as a nature saying, probably he has still in his heart not forgiven us for what we did, because at the end we still cannot communicate in the same language. Mm-hmm. We still cannot hold hands. He was not with his father all these years, because even when he is a master, he didn't have the hug of the father that he had the first 12 years or so. So it was something that, oops, we really separated him from the father. That was the glue, like you said. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And probably he were thinking, now he's getting back to us because that
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, to put it all together, they saw that the father was dead. There must have been something in the behavior of Joseph. There must have been something in the atmosphere. There must have been something in the interaction between the brothers and Yosef that was different now that father was dead. When it says they saw the father was dead, notice they felt the influence of his lack. They felt that something was different. And because they felt that something was different, that something was missing, something was fishy around her, something was bad, something went wrong in the relationships of the family, now that the father is dead, because they felt that something was wrong, they had a premonition therefore that Yosef was going to do something bad to them. So they said, we have to head the evil off at the pass. We have to do something. We have to beg for forgiveness. We have to begin a process of reconciliation. Because now that father is dead, it feels like all hell is going to break loose. I want to look at a midrash now that concretizes this difference that happened in the atmosphere because father was dead. So if we look at the back of the first page, at the bottom of the page, I brought from a midrash called Midrash Rabbah, a collection of rabbinic midrashim, and now we're looking at the midrashim in the book of Genesis. It's section 100, part 8. And Joseph returned into Egypt, and when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said it may be that Joseph will hate us, etc. Rabbi Levi and Rabbi Isaac disagree. Rabbi Levi said they feared this because he did not invite them to dine with him. So it seems to imply that while Yaakov was alive, the family used to often dine together. Perhaps every Shabbat morning they had a Shabbat meal together. And now, and of course, where did they do it? At Yosef's place. It was the biggest place. He had a big palace there and a big table and servants. But now that father was dead, he did not invite them. Joseph didn't invite the brothers to dine with him anymore. Rabbi Tanhum observed, his motive indeed was a noble one. For he reasoned, formerly my father placed me above Yehuda, who is a king, and above Reuven, who is the firstborn. But now it is not right for me to sit above them. This is classic. This probably happens in most families. So what's going on? First, let me give you the basic background. So when father was alive, he was a patriarch, even though the meals were hosted in Joseph's palace. But Yaakov arranged where everyone would sit, and he always put Joseph at the head of the table, because Joseph was the host, and Joseph was the second in command of the state of Egypt. He should sit at the head. And all the other brothers sat in the places that Yaakov gave them. But now that Father Yaakov is not with us anymore, Joseph is making the list to call his brothers to invite them for Shabbat lunch, and he says to himself, okay, we're going to have this meal together. Father's no longer with us. We have to still maintain the family tradition, and I'll sit. Wait a second, where am I going to sit? If I put myself at the head of a table, well, that doesn't look good. I put myself at the head when my father would put me there was okay, but now I shouldn't sit there, so I'll sit on the side. But wait, who should I put at the head? If I put this brother there, this one will be angry. Put this brother there, what am I going to do? So he gets so confused and so uptight. How are we going to sit? He decides, you know what? This week, I won't invite the guys over. We'll wait for a week. We'll get over our father's death. Next week, I'll invite them over. Next week, he starts to call them up. Wait a second. Where are they going to sit? I won't invite them this week. And he never invites them over because he doesn't know where to sit them. He's afraid of embarrassing someone, doing the wrong thing. And his brothers see that one week he doesn't invite them, next week doesn't invite them, and they start to say, ah, he must be planning something against us. He must be angry. And this whole rigmarole begins, this internal turmoil, these questions, these mutual recriminations. What's going on there? It was all the shame shemaim. It was all for the sake of heaven. It was a good reason. He didn't invite them because he didn't know where to sit them. But they interpret it differently. They, however, did not speak thus, but it may be that Joseph will hate us. They didn't know that his motivation of not inviting them was because he didn't know where they would sit. They thought his motivation was that he's planning to get them. So they think he's going to hate them. Rabbi Isaac said something else. I'm reading from the Midrash. He has a different interpretation of what the brothers saw and felt and experienced after the death of Yaakov that caused them to think that Joseph was planning something against them. It's the continuation of the same Midrash. Rabbi Isaac said they feared because he had gone and looked into that pit. What pit? Well, they just came back from burying father in Canaan. And the Midrash assumes that while they were on their way to Canaan, or on the way back, they passed by that pit where so many decades ago they had did their ugly deed and thrown Yosef into it. And they noticed the pit, but they tried to ignore it. Joseph noticed the pit. How could he ignore it? And they saw Joseph looking at the pit. And they saw, or they thought they saw, the look in his eyes. And they saw, or they thought they saw, what was going on in his brain. And they said, if Joseph is now reminded of that pit, he must be planning something against us. Now that idea of the pit is further developed in an earlier Midrash at the top of the page. Let's look at this one. It begins with the same verse. Joseph's brothers began to realize the implications of their father's death. They saw that their father was dead. And what did they realize now such that they were fearful? When they were returning from their father's burial, they saw Joseph go and utter a benediction at the pit into which his brothers had thrown him. For you must recite a blessing at the place where a miracle was performed for you. And so he declared, Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed is he who wrought a miracle for me in this place. When his brothers saw this, they exclaimed, it may be that Joseph will hate us. In other words, he sees this pit, he goes to the pit, he looks in the pit, and he seems to be muttering something under his breath. The brothers are seeing him from afar. They don't know he's muttering a blessing. They think he's muttering, oh, I remember all they did to me, I'm going to get back at them.
And all this pit is invented because it's not in the Torah.
The Torah doesn't say anything about them visiting the pit. But we're trying to understand what happened. What did the brothers see after Yaakov's death that caused them to believe that Yosef would be out to get them? And it turns out, according to these Midrashim, it was nothing objective. It's all subjective projection in their own minds. Because they're full of guilt. Okay, guys, all that is background to what we're finally getting to right now. So what we said is that during these 10 weeks of study together, we'll be examining the weekly Torah portion, but from the point of view of a small number of Hasidic masters from the 18th and 19th centuries that developed beautifully explicit and very often psychologically insightful interpretations of the Torah portion. What we're going to see today is from a Hasidic master whose book is the Me'ah Shiloach. You can see how old and worn my copy is, who's in Poland in a town called Izbich, and therefore it's called Izbicher Hasidut. The Me'ah Shiloach is Rabbi Mordechai Liner. The years we're talking about are about 1860 to 1880. Approximately 1860 to 1880. He spoke the words we're about to read. He spoke them to his Hasidim, probably around the Shabbat table at the end of Shabbat in the afternoon, Saturday afternoon, Suda Shlishit, the third meal. And he did not record. Obviously, there was no recording device, and he didn't take any notes of what he said. But apparently, after he spoke, his grandson recorded from memory what he spoke about and translated it from Yiddish to Hebrew, and that's what we have in front of us. Now, when I say that's what we have in front of us, that's what I have in front of me. I have in front of me the Hebrew. There's an English translation that I brought for you on the sheets. This is the English translation. This translation is one of the worst translations of any Hebrew work I know. One can always get upset with the translation. It missed this nuance, it missed that nuance. But this translation didn't just miss nuance. It didn't understand the Hebrew, unfortunately. So in 90% of the cases, it gets it right. But some places, the translator just didn't understand. So I'm going to read the Hebrew. You have the English in front of you. And I'm going to translate it for myself. And in the places where I think the translator made a mistake, I wrote on the side, in the margin there, that we have to take note here. You ready?
Yes.
It's important to note the opening phrase that this Hasidic homily is based upon. So it's based upon, you thought evil of me, but Elohim thought it for the good. Right? That's Bereishit 50:20. Now that might be a different translation than the one you have in the JPS. Let's just check out the JPS and make sure we understand that verse in context. So that was 50:20, and the way the JPS translated it was
Beside.
Although you intended me harm, God intended it for the good. Okay? Now let's see what the Hasidic master, Rav Mordechai Liner, says about this. So again, you have the English, I'm reading the Hebrew, and I'm going to give my own translation. Bezeh ha'inyan, hira Hashem mitbarach, ech haya be'efshar levi ha'shvatim begalut Mitzrayim. In this matter, God, may He be blessed, shows how it was possible to bring the tribes into Egyptian exile. Veikar haya hapirud shitchilu pared, and the main reason was the separations that they began to be separated. So what he's basically saying is that God is showing us here the reason, the cause for the Egyptian exile. And it's a punishment. It's a punishment for the separation, and a better word than separation would be strife or conflict or differences, tension between the tribes. When you say between the tribes, we mean between Joseph and his brothers. They are the tribes. So the Me'ah Shiloach, Rav Mordechai Liner, is making a statement that the fact that the Jewish people were slaves in Egypt, were in Egyptian exile, was a punishment brought upon them by God for the strife within the family. Ki be'et she'Yisrael ba'achdut lo yuchal lishlot aleihem shum davar. Because when the Jewish people are united, nothing can go wrong. But of course, when there is strife, when there is conflict, then things can go wrong. And of course, he seems to be making a theological statement, but you can also understand it on a sociological level. Theologically, he says God punished them with Egyptian exile because they were in strife. But sociologically, we can understand it just as well. That when a family, when a nation, when a tribe is united, when they accept each other, when relationships are done properly, well, things tend to go well. But when there's strife, when there's misunderstandings, when people don't get along in the family or in the tribe or in the nation, then bad things can happen. That's pretty much a truism. That unity and a sense of collective cohesiveness and understanding is the key to success on the level of the family, the tribe, and the nation. Vanyan bezehaya she piresh Yosef min hashvatim ki ba'od Yaakov avinu haya kayam lo haya nikar mimenu ki hu gadol shebashvatim, etc. And the matter is that Joseph separated himself from his brothers. So he's saying that the strife that we're talking about, the strife that caused the difficulties, is not necessarily just what happened decades ago when the brothers sold him into slavery, but it's right now, after father's death, that Joseph is separating himself from his brothers. Which of course reminds us of the Midrashim we read 10 minutes ago, how he didn't invite them over for dinner. Because while Father Yaakov was alive, it wasn't clear from him, from Father Yaakov, who was the most exalted of the tribes of the brothers. Ki lefamim ayam mekerevet zeyuter, lefamim zeyuter, eze shaya yeshar beinav botasha. Because sometimes Yaakov would favor this brother and sometimes this brother, whichever he wanted to at that time. In other words, Yaakov Avinu created a certain balance. Sometimes this brother was sat at the head of the table, sometimes this brother, and he alternated it so there wouldn't be any favoritism. But as soon as Yaakov died, then Joseph separated himself from his brothers. And now he goes on to explain further. Ach kodem leptirato b'shasha birkam. But before his death, before Yaakov's death, when he blessed them, v'amar liyudah yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha, and he said concerning Judah that your brothers will bow down to you, az ikiru kulam ki Yehuda gavar bechav, then everyone understood that Yehuda would be the greatest of the brothers. V'lechach lo haya Yosef yudei litneheg, and that's why Joseph did not know how to behave after his father's death. Bim lo shivat Yehuda barosh, if he would put Judah at the head of the table, halohu melech vasulas as the melech, that wouldn't be good. That would be problematic. I wrote in the margin there, right? That would be problematic because Joseph himself is king. How could he put someone else at the head of the table? Ubeim sheyeshev hu batzmo, but if Joseph would put himself at the head of the table, barosh halo yudea batzmo yudahu harosh. But that would be problematic because he knows, because of father's blessing, Yaakov's blessing before his death, that Judah is destined to be the king. Alken yashab b'fnei atzmo v'lo im ha-shvatim. And that's why he sat by himself and not with his brothers. I'm going to stop for a second. What our author is doing until this point, he's saying nothing new. He's basically paraphrasing, in his own words, the Midrash we just read. He's saying in a different fashion the same thing that we read in the Midrash, that he didn't invite his brothers over because he had some type of question of how to seat them. That's his separation from the brothers. That caused strife. Again, it was for a good purpose. Not a good purpose, but it wasn't because he was angry at them. He just didn't know how to behave. He was confused. So there's nothing newer. And probably what's happening is, although I'm not certain, the author has a memory of the Midrash, he doesn't have it in front of him, and he's kind of paraphrasing it in his own language. V'shvatim danu oto shasa zot machmat sina. But the brothers, the tribes, judged Joseph that he was doing what he did because of hate of them, because he wanted to take revenge. V'lechach ne'enshu liot begalut. And therefore they were punished with exile because they should have judged him favorably. That's already something new that wasn't in the Midrash. What our author is claiming is that the sin here is not so much the separation and the strife between the brothers, it's the fact that the brothers did not fulfill the directive of judging others favorably. They saw that Joseph wasn't inviting them over for Shabbat, for dinner, and they immediately jumped to the conclusion that he must hate us. He didn't fulfill the commandment, the precept of judging others favorably. Now, I want to stop for a second and just give some background. There's no place explicitly in the Torah that it says there's a mitzvah to judge others favorably. But there's a verse that the rabbis interpret to mean that. It's in the middle of the book of Leviticus. Actually, we won't have time to look at it. In any case, in the English, it won't be clear. But in any case, according to rabbinic exegesis, there's a mitzvah to judge others favorably. And this is one of the most powerful mitzvot in the whole Torah. Because just think, and it's so fitting to what we're reading now, and it's so fitting to everyone's lives. Just think how many times strife is caused, and misunderstandings, and hate, and tension, and marital discord, and problems within families, because we assume bad about other people, and it wasn't true. What an example. I didn't get an invitation from my uncle for Thanksgiving. I didn't get an invitation from my brother for New Year's. And I'm thinking in my mind, what did I do? He probably thinks that I did something wrong to him. Oh, it's because I didn't send him a New Year's card, and he must be so angry with me. And then I make up all these stories in my mind of what's going on, and it's a disaster, and it's based on nothing. Nothing happened. He didn't invite me for New Year's because he forgot, or he went out of town, he went to the Bahamas, whatever it might be. And the Torah says, according to the rabbis, always judge favorably. Always try and think of your mind some scenario to explain more innocuously, more innocently what's happening. And you know, sometimes you might be wrong. Sometimes there really might be evil intentions behind what's happening, but that's really not important. If you always make the effort to judge favorably, it'll only make things better. It'll only make things better. So much strife and so much pain and so much psychological distress and inner churning can be saved just by judging every situation favorably. But they didn't judge favorably. And according to the Meshiloach, not judging favorably is so bad, and it's so destructive, and it's so corrosive. For that, the Jewish people were punished with Galut Mitzrayim, with the exile in Egypt, with the slavery, because they didn't judge favorably. I don't know if you have to take it literally, but just understand the point that he's making, how corrosive it could be on so many different levels when we don't make every effort to fulfill the principle of judging other people in the most favorable light, making every effort to understand that things were done properly or for the proper intention. Now let's go on. V'gam leYosef nechshav lechet, but for Joseph was also considered to be a sin. Alasher hiniach lehem makom litot bo, because he gave them a reason. Mistranslation. He gave them a basis to be mistaken. Now, what that means is that if someone judges me unfavorably, that person's doing wrong. But if I did something that gives them the impression that I did wrong, such that they might judge me unfavorably, I also did something wrong. Because I have an obligation not only to do the right thing, but also to make it appear that I did the right thing. Because if I do the right thing, but it's not clear to other people I did the right thing, then they're liable to misjudge me. And it's, in a certain sense, I am putting a stumbling block in front of them by doing the right thing in a fashion that makes it look as if I did the wrong thing. Because then they might judge me unfavorably. So I have to make every effort not only to do the right thing, but to do what has to be done so that other people won't misjudge me. And Joseph, even though he didn't do anything intentionally wrong, but by not inviting them, he gave them a basis for a mistake, a mistaken interpretation. He should have been more careful. He should have explained himself. He should have had a dialogue with them, communication. So he's also guilty. Ki b'met haya lo litneheg shu yoshev v'rosh me'achar shel eit atahu melech. Because he really should have invited them and sat at the head of the table, because at this point he is the king. And in his heart he could have known that Yehuda is the king for the future, but presently he's the king, he's in charge, so he should have sat at the head of the table. I'm going to skip two lines where I wrote in the margin that there's a complete misunderstanding in the English translation. I'm going to skip those two lines, and we're going to go on. And for this, one must always pray to God, may He be blessed, Shelo yavo bidato ladun et chevero lechov, that He'll never come to judge others improperly. You should always pray to God that you don't fall into the trap of judging others improperly. You know what? It's a trap that we're so liable every day to fall into. It's so easy to think bad things about other people. People who cut you off in line at the supermarket, and people who went through a red light and almost hit you, and so many different things. Your neighbor who walks his dog without picking up after it, and the mailman who didn't bring the mail today, and the newspaper guy who the paper was wet in the rain. There are so many ways to judge others unfavorably, and it's a constant temptation. You have to pray to God, he says, to help you avoid the temptation, avoid falling in the pit of judging others unfavorably. V'gam shechaviro lo yuduno lechov. And you also have to pray that others won't judge you unfavorably. Not just that you'll judge others favorably, that others will judge you favorably. And that's why the tribes were punished, that they didn't judge favorably. So, that in and of itself, I think, is pretty important, just to emphasize the idea and the commandment of judging favorably. But there's something deeper that we have to now go into. And it's the following. Given everything we just learned, and given the style we know of Jewish interpretation of Scripture, that it's this interpretation is appended to a verse, or is it an interpretation of a verse, interpretation of a different verse, interpretation of another verse. We want to go back and look now, everything we just learned, the interpretation we just learned, to what verse do you think that it relates as far as its substance goes? Let's open up the text in chapter 50. What verse does this substantially relate to? So I'm looking in the text. I'm looking in chapter 50, verses 15 to 20. I'm looking around. And I look at verse 15. Right? When Joseph's brothers saw that the father was dead, and as they saw that the atmosphere was different, that Joseph was behaving strangely, or so they thought, they said, what if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong that we did him? So there's where they judged him unfavorably. And I would think, therefore, that the Hasidic interpretation about judging favorably and unfavorably that we just read should have been appended to that verse. But it's not. Look in the text. Which verse is appended to?
20.
To verse 20. So now that's the question that we're going to use as a jumping off point to find something deeper here. Someone hear where I am? Right? So the question is, what does this whole matter of judging favorably have to do with verse 20? Why isn't it said on verse 15? So that's a question I'm giving you to think about for 2 minutes. What's the connection between judging favorably and verse 20? And that will be a key to what our author is really trying to tell us.
This verse 20 is not connected to the 15 because Joseph is talking about the past. Joseph here is talking about that you intended me harm. That was when he was younger, and the outcome is because God is on top of everything. So the ever happy situation that you are saying here, that always judge favorably, is difficult, because the business proof that if you are saying that all your associates are going to do well with you in business, be careful, because they can stab you in your back or in your stomach just in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So But God is on top of everything. even when you are not thinking favorably to everything, at the end, ultimate is what God wants. And even when they didn't know at the beginning what would happen years later, all this famine, and even today in history, we learn about what happened in that time. God had a plan to start with.
Okay, but everything you're saying is good, but I don't think you're answering my question, right?
What's the question?
What's the question again? The question is, what is the connection between everything that our Hasidic author, Rabbi Mordechai Lina, said and verse 20? Why does he put it, why does he append it to verse 20 and not verse 15?
Well, because the survival of the people, that goal, I started out backwards, I think. It's the idea, it's the idea that, because I was listening to her, and it's very interesting, that evil can be made good, just like good can be made evil. And the survival of the people is based on not being short-sighted, but realizing the potential of any situation.
Yes, indeed. You're getting very close. You're getting
can be changed.
Okay. You're getting very close. It could be that you said it. I'm not sure. But Myra and then Ruth and Carol Ann. Myra?
Didn't it start out, though, like the brothers judged Joseph unfavorably, and the results were to their benefit, so to speak, down the road.
Right.
Now, Joseph is trying to teach them that judging unfavorably... I'm not really sure how to say it. He's not judging them unfavorably. I can't say it. I'll think of it in a minute. Has to do with him being judged unfavorably, having a good result.
Okay, but you're not explaining further. Ruth?
Well, sort of what Barbara said. He set the pattern for forgiving and turning it into good, and they didn't follow, the brothers didn't follow that pattern, because they immediately, thought he evil because of the dinner problem.
Okay, and say it again, I'm not sure I understood.
Well, that when he, earlier he forgave them when he went by the little the hole.
Yeah,
and he turned it into good. He said it was a blessing, but he set the pattern of forgiving them, and they heard that, but they didn't follow that pattern or that way of forgiving when it started with the whole business with the table.
But how does it relate to verse 20?
Well,
right, that's the question. The Hasidic author, we're learning, related this whole thing to verse 20, and what's the connection? There seems to be no connection.
Okay. I think because it's important to judge people favorably because you don't know what God's plan is the reason for what they happened.
Okay, we're getting close, but there's a point that it's missing.
Results are not predetermined by the initial act.
Mm-hmm, okay.
So that what appears to be evil...
Yeah, I hear. There's something going on here. So let me give you some background here. The Hasidic author, Rav Mordechai Liner, allows himself to take great liberty with the text very often. He will present to us radical reinterpretations of a text, which are not necessarily the pshat. When I say the pshat, I mean the meaning in context. But the Hasidic authors will very often take a verse out of context and see if it could mean something else that won't fit into the context, but will teach us something broader or deeper or other. So now, verse 20. Part of what Joseph said, I'll read 19 and 20. But Joseph said to them, "Have no fear. Am I a substitute for God? Besides, although you intended me harm, God intended it for good so as to bring about the present result, the survival of many people." On the level of pshat, in context, what is Joseph saying? He's saying, look, you guys did evil. But who am I to punish you? I'll leave it to God to punish you. And secondly, he's saying, how could I punish you? you intended evil, but you were only pawns of God. God had a larger purpose in mind, something very good. So how can I punish you? Because it was part of something good. And this is something many of you just said, right? That's in context. But when our Hasidic author connects his words about judging favorably to verse 20, we have to go back to verse 20 and try to understand that the Hasidic author is interpreting verse 20 completely different than everything I just said. Completely different. His interpretation is the following. When it says God intended it for good, I'll go back to the beginning of 20. You intended me harm, God intended it for good. The Hebrew that's translated here as intended, the Hebrew word is chashav, to think or to consider. The author that we're reading is interpreting it to mean that although you thought of what you were doing as evil, God thought of it as good. It's not that God used you as a pawn to accomplish something good, but God considered your act as good. In other words, and here's the bombshell, according to the author, God was practicing the commandment of judging favorably. God was performing the commandment of judging favorably. In other words, think of God looking at the world and seeing things happen. And he sees that Joseph is taken by his brothers and thrown into a pit and sold into slavery. And later, Joseph becomes the viceroy of the country of Egypt, where he's sold into slavery. He interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And that interpretation brings him to greatness. He becomes the second in command, and he saves the world from famine. That's what happened. According to our Hasidic interpretation, that's appending the whole idea of judging favorably to verse 20. Verse 20 has Joseph saying the following. Despite what you guys were thinking when you sold me into slavery, God was judging you favorably because he saw the result. And it doesn't fit into the context. It doesn't matter. But what the author is doing, he's telling us that we have to learn an example from God. God judged them favorably. God saw them doing what they did in order to accomplish a greater goal. Again, this is not the simple meaning of the verse. That's not what it means in context. But the author is using it to teach us a lesson. Now, we have many midrashim of the rabbis of the classical period, 2,000 years before the Hasidic author, in which God is depicted as doing good in the world. If you remember when Abraham did his circumcision, so it says that God appeared to him in the book of Genesis. And the rabbis say that God was visiting the sick. Avram had undergone operation, and just like God visits the sick, so should we visit the sick. Just like God provides food to the hungry, we should provide food to the hungry. Just like God buries the dead, he buried Moses when he died, so we should bury the dead. In other words, we learn examples from God. And now we're saying that God judged the brothers favorably. God thought it, considered it as good. So we also should judge other people good, because that's what God does. So all we're doing here is we're elevating the idea of judging others favorably one level higher, because we're seeing it as something that is an emulation of God. And that's just a way of making the mitzvah that more powerful, the mitzvah of judging others favorably. What does God judge favorably? So we also should judge favorably. Anyone want to say, yeah, Myra?
Well, that sort of falls into the category of why do bad things happen to good people?
Explain.
Well, that happened, I mean, God had a plan that Joseph, that was bad for Joseph, but it turned out to be good.
Right. Exactly. But again, that is the pshat. But that's not what our Hasidic author is talking about.
Right. No.
Right. That's certainly true.
It's an aside.
We actually even talked about that in the class that I give Thursday mornings about why do bad things happen to good people. So I want to... Oh, goodness gracious. There's no time left. So I'll just take 1 minute. Let's see, I can sum this up in 1 minute.
You can take two, Rabbi.
I'll just take 2 minutes briefly. I'll tell you that it often turns out that Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of the reconstituted Jewish settlement of the land of Israel at the beginning of the 20th century, it often turned out that in his writings he is learning from and building upon what we have here in the Me'ah Shiloach. And Rav Kook famously explained that Charles Darwin, when he published his book on the origin of species, that Charles Darwin was uncovering and publicizing one of the major principles of Judaism. Evolution, which so many people view as antithetical to religion, as an enemy of religion, as coming out against the creation of the world by God, Rav Kook taught us that every person, not only every person, but also every movement and idea should be judged favorably. Rav Kook took the idea of judging favorably and expanded it. You can also judge not just people, but movements and ideas and philosophies favorably. You can always try to find the kernel of goodness, the kernel of truth, not just in your fellow, but in the political party you don't believe in, and in the country you don't believe in, and the leader you don't believe in, and the politician you don't believe in. And while the whole Jewish world, and the Christian world also, was excoriating Darwin's theories for being anti-religious, Rav Kook explained that in the theory of evolution, there's actually a great kernel of religious truth. Because Darwin was saying that everything is in a process of improving. Rav Kook said that means everything is in a process of doing tshuva. Everything's in a process of coming closer to God. Everything's in a religious movement in which it's becoming better, and human beings also should learn from the universe. The plants are becoming better, the animals are becoming better, the species are becoming better. You also should become better. You also should do tshuva. You also should evolve, just like the whole world is evolving. All I'm trying to say is give an example how Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook took what we have in the Me'ah Shiloach of emphasizing the centrality of the mitzvah of judging favorably, and he applied it not just to the people, but to ideas. Judge ideas favorably. Look for the kernel of truth. If you're a Democrat, look for the kernel of truth among the Republicans. If you're a Republican, look for the kernel of truth among the Democrats. Right? If you're for, Romney, think about the good that Obama does, and if you're from Obama, think about the good that Romney could do. Always try to judge not just people, but even movements with an eye towards favorability and greater contribution to the universe. Okay.
Difficult though.